Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Lord Chris Patten, government coordinator for the papal visit to Britain, talks about his faith, his hopes, and the challenges ahead of the Pope's arrival on September the 16th. Plus, the very special relationship between Christians and Jews, at the heart of the work of one international congregation of religious sisters, currently concluding their general chapter right here in Rome. In the 1980s, he was a high-flying government minister and chairman of the Conservative Party. In the 1990s, he was the last governor of Hong Kong, overseeing the handover to Chinese rule. Following that, he became an EU commissioner, a member of the House of Lords, and the Chancellor of Oxford University. He's also a cradle Catholic, a keen Arsenal Football Club supporter, and the author of several books on politics and diplomacy. His latest task is that of government coordinator for the historic state visit of Pope Benedict to Britain in mid-September. He is, of course, Lord Chris Patten, and he came to Vatican Radio this week to talk to me about his faith, his hopes, and the challenges of the coming weeks. Lord Chris Patten, welcome to Vatican Radio. The public perception is perhaps that you were brought in as something of a troubleshooter to help with some of the problems that emerged in the preparation of this visit. Can you give us, first of all, perhaps your version of the story?
The Prime Minister asked me to do it, not because the previous government had made a terrible mess of things, but because, plainly, we'd had an election campaign and there had been something of a hiatus in getting the arrangements in place. And I think there was an awareness on the Prime Minister's part that we were in danger of falling behind the clock and needed to pull everything together fairly rapidly. But an awful lot of very good work had been done by the previous administration and by officials. There had been one awful mistake made by a couple of young Foreign Office officials. But apart from that, I think the government machine has been working very well. And I'm absolutely confident that all the arrangements put in place by government, by local government, by the bishops' conferences in Scotland and in England will ensure that the visit is a terrific success.
What do you see, perhaps, then, as the biggest challenges in this job over the coming weeks?
I think the biggest challenge is, I hope, we've overcome by putting in place a structure to manage the whole visit as appropriately as possible. I think at the outset, and this is no criticism, people had perhaps underestimated the complexity involved in fitting together both the state visit aspects and the pastoral aspects so that they were a seamless whole. It's incomparably more difficult arranging the state visit of the Holy Father than it would be arranging the state visit of even I suspect, President Obama. President Obama doesn't go out and meet 100,000 people at an open-air venue or whatever. So the difficulties of getting this all together were, I think, perhaps a little underestimated, but I think we're now on top of things. And I think the overall shape of the programme is really exciting. It will ensure, I hope, not only that the Catholic community and the faith communities are able to relate very closely to the Pope at pastoral events and interfaith events, but I think it also gives us the opportunity to demonstrate that the government of a largely non-Catholic country still has a formidably large agenda to work with the Catholic Church. Many of the things about which the government feels most strongly, like overseas development, like accomplishing the Millennium Development Goals, like global equity, climate change, sustainability with the environment, disarmament issues, as well as its domestic agenda of strengthening the relations between community groups and faith groups, all that, when we parade the importance of this relationship, will, I think, surprise some people who may have been critical of the visit in the first place.
There certainly has been a certain amount of criticism. There is a very vocal minority intent on protesting this visit. Is this a serious concern to you?
No. We live in a free society. America, Australia and others are the same. And I think it's recognised that if people want to protest peacefully, then they have every right to do so. I think they represent a very small minority of the community, but I don't think anybody would want to snuff out their right to protest. I think it's curious that some people think that there's as much to protest about as when, say, the head of a totalitarian country was coming to the United Kingdom, but there it is. What we're very concerned to ensure is not only the security of the Holy Father, but also that the pastoral events aren't disrupted, because that, I think, would give a serious offence. But proper protest within the law is something that one should recognise as one of the signs of freedom.
Some of the criticism has been focused on what are seen to be mounting costs of this papal visit at the same time as the government is urging spending cuts right across the board. What do you say to that?
Well, the costs are going to be slightly higher for the reason that I mentioned earlier, that it is more complicated to put the visit together than we anticipated originally. I think the costs for the church will be greater and the costs for the taxpayer will be greater. I've said myself that I envisage the costs for the taxpayer being in the range of 10 to 12 million. In addition, there are policing costs. But when you think that last year we had a meeting of the G20, which was one day and cost 19 or 20 million, and none of the G20 leaders were going to events with 80 or 100,000 people, I think it makes you realise that we should keep all this in context. Because we have a difficult fiscal situation in the United Kingdom at the moment, doesn't mean that we abandon our relationship with the rest of the world, and the role of the Catholic Church in the rest of the world is hugely important to us.
You said recently, though, that Britain must be the most avowedly secular country the Pope has travelled to. What exactly do you mean by that? Are you talking statistics or attitude to this visit particularly?
Now, I'm not talking about the attitudes to this visit particularly. I'm talking about issues like church attendance and the extent to which I think meretriciousness, as well as intellectually developed and formed agnosticism or atheism, have taken such a large part on the public and the media agenda. Now, it's of course the case that Catholic Church, partly through immigration, is one of the few churches which is expanding. Also, there are other faith groups who've seen increases in membership, like Islamic groups. But by and large, I think in comparison with, say, the United States, we would not be able to point to so many people for whom God was a really important part of their lives. There's a line in a very good book by Julian Barnes about death, in which Barnes actually begins the book with this line, saying to his brother that, I don't believe in God, but I do miss him. And I think that is, there's a sense in which that's true of a lot of people in Britain at the moment.
You also talk about intolerance to religious belief, perhaps outright hostility. Is this particularly directed at the Catholic Church, do you think, or not?
I think it's particularly directed at the Catholic Church because of the Catholic Church's prominence and longevity and self-confidence in asserting some basic truths, which we believe to be basic truths. I think that's meant that the Catholic Church, with its rich and sometimes controversial history, has attracted particular odium, often expressed in a rather superficial way by intellectuals and others. But I don't worry too much about that. I think we have to stand our ground, recognising when we do so that we've often been intolerant to others ourselves in the past. We should be arguing that it's ironic that some secularists, not all, are being as intolerant of church groups as church groups were of them in the past. And I think that's one of the many ironies of life.
In this context, though, how difficult is it going to be to get the Pope's message through to get it out to the public through a media which is more interested often in superficial details of which superstars are around and what gadgets are on sale and so on. It's going to be hard to get the Pope's message through, isn't it?
Not necessarily. First of all, it may be more difficult to get across the message that faith is not a problem, that faith is for many people the way they cope with the challenges of living in the 21st century. I think it should be easier to get across that many of the issues that are raised by the church, particularly given the interests of a younger generation, issues of social equity globally, I think it should be easier to get those things across. It's probably not known that 25% of education in sub-Saharan Africa is provided by the church, that 25% of healthcare in subsequent sub-Saharan Africa is provided by church and church groups. I think the role of church groups in caring for those who are suffering from HIV/AIDS isn't as well known as one would like it to be. So I hope that perhaps there'll be more concentration on those things. I hope there'll be more recognition of what the church says about sustainable development, and what's said, for example, in Caritas in the Encyclical Veritate. So I hope that we're able to get those messages across clearly, thanks to His Holiness being in the United Kingdom, having so many huge audiences to address. I'm not at all pessimistic about that.
Can I ask you, finally, on a personal note about your own Catholic faith, how important this has been to you in your political life?
It's been important to me as a cradle Catholic with Irish roots on my father's side. It's important to me in this sense. It's not like being a supporter of Arsenal Football Club, which I am. It's not like being a member of the Conservative Party, which I am. It's much more fundamental than that. It's part of my DNA. And like a lot of Catholics, I've had doubts and difficulties from time to time. But I think of the Catholic Church, I think of Christianity starting with a crisis on Good Friday, and think that my own occasional moments of doubt are as nothing compared with that. I don't think I could get to my age and start thinking rather more regularly about mortality if I didn't have the comfort of my faith. That may be a weakness on my part, but I remember Basil Hume. Well, I was told that Basil Hume, when he was a schoolmaster, was asked by potential parents of boys at his school what he was preparing the boys for, and he said death. And when you get into your late 60s, you start to think of the wisdom of that observation rather more, and I don't think I could cope with that if I wasn't a Catholic, with all the feelings of guilt and inadequacy and sometimes enthusiasm and hope which that entails, and which many novelists have written about so well.
My thanks there to Lord Chris Patton, Government Coordinator for the Papal visit to Britain in September. God's faithful love for the Jewish people and the Christian Church's inextricable links to their history and destiny. Those principles are at the heart of the work of the Congregation of Our Lady of Zion, founded in the mid-1800s by two Jewish brothers who began to realise the inseparable nature of the Old and New Testaments.
We are inextricably bound. And the Jewish people today are alive and well and don't need to become Christian. This is the extraordinary mystery that we have to live with.
That's Sister Maureen Cusick, the outgoing Superior General of the Sisters of Our Lady of Zion, who've been holding their general chapter here in Rome throughout the month of July. Delegates from countries around the world have been discussing a renewal process begun in 2007 to try and make the work of the sisters more relevant and more effective in the pursuit of justice, peace and interreligious understanding in our global yet increasingly fragmented and often polarised world. I sat down with Sister Maureen to find out more about the origins of this rather unusual congregation and the most pressing challenges facing its members today.
Usually the theme of a general chapter is connected with an evaluation of the past 6 years and a looking forward to the next 6 years. And it's always at a general chapter, a new superior general is elected or the same one is re-elected. So this year we've chosen... Really, the title of the chapter would be In Sion Firmata Sum, which is a phrase from the book of Ecclesiasticus. In Sion I will make my dwelling, and it's to do with the mountain of Jerusalem, very significant for us. The mountain of Jerusalem, there are two mountains, important mountains in the Bible. One is Mount Sinai, where the Torah was given and the establishment of the Jewish people. And Mount Sion is... where the Torah will dwell, and that is for the establishment of the nations. So we would see that particularly significant theme for our chapter and for the charism of our congregation, that we have this love for the Jewish people because they were chosen by God, and a love of the nations because they were chosen by God. So these two mountains, so Mount Sion, we have it on our ring, we have it on our, in our constitutions, and so that little text, a biblical text, is highly significant for us. And it's in many of the Psalms, it's not just in Ecclesiasticus, it's quoted all over the Bible. In Sion I will make my dwelling place. So that would be our, it's not the theme, but it's almost the symbol of who we are and the foundation. It's how the congregation was really founded.
Let's go back a little bit and look at that founding of the congregation. Why and why this particular relationship with the Jewish world?
Our founder was a Jew. In fact, there were two Jewish brothers. The first one was studying philosophy from a wealthy Jewish family in Strasbourg. Not a believer, not the whole family were not necessarily practicing Jews. But nevertheless, they were from a banking family. And Theodore, the young Theodore, studying philosophy, eventually came to understand Christianity and embraced Christianity. And so, of course, he was, even though it was not a practicing family, he was alienated from the family. His youngest brother, a good 10 years younger, came to Christianity in a very different way. And there's the very famous, it's spoken about as the miracle of the 20th of January. The young Alphonse Ratisbon was in Rome for a holiday before his wedding, his marriage. And he was with a Christian friend in a Catholic church in Sant'Andrea del Frate, and he had a deep, deep experience of Mary. And it was an instantaneous, he felt deeply called to Christianity. So the two brothers, mostly Theodore, the older of the two, founded the congregation at that time in the 19th century. It would have been to help what he felt was his brothers and sisters, Jews, to come to the light that he had discovered. So that would have been the theology at that time. We never proselytized, we would never make converts, but underlying our spirituality was certainly that understanding from Theodore, although even Theodore never, never, never discussed or even pretended that that's what we were about, converting Jews. That was never in it. But of course, it was underlying the Christian theology of the 19th century.
It was a difficult tension, perhaps, to hold in those days, this mission to the Jews and yet not converting, not proselytizing. It's at the heart of the Jewish-Christian relationship.
Exactly. It's not so difficult today because, well, certainly since Vatican II, Nostra Aetate, the document that was this amazing transformative document that enabled the church to come, and that's through Cardinal Bea, to really truly come to understand itself in relationship to the Jewish people, that we are inextricably bound, and that the Jewish people today are alive and well and don't need to become Christian. This is the extraordinary mystery that we have to live with. And in terms of Jewish-Christian relations today, there's still a huge amount of work to do.
Let's talk about the work today then. You're present in countries all over the world, aren't you?
We're present in 21. We're quite a small congregation now, just under 450 members. We're present in 20 countries around the world. So we're in Central America, we're in North America, Europe, of course, Britain, Ireland, Australia, Philippines, Poland, well, we're across Europe, the Middle East, of course, various countries in the Middle East, and of course Jerusalem, which is at the heart of the congregation. And we would be working, certainly where it's possible, in very direct Jewish-Christian relations, but everybody in whatever country they're living in is working in trying to help Christians understand the background of their Christianity in Judaism. And so the Bible, the whole Bible, is vitally important for us, the whole Bible. There's no way we can understand the New Testament if we haven't understood the First Testament.
Let's look at then, you're talking about a smallish community. What are the main challenges, perhaps, regarding new vocations and the growth of the order?
Yes, the challenges around that, of course, are enormous. But we face them in sense of, yes, we certainly would want new members, consecrated women, to join our communities. But our main focus is, in fact, our charism. And our charism is this deep awareness of God's love for the Jewish people and therefore our love for the Jewish people. It's a very specific and unusual charism. Whomever is interested and involved in that passionately, of course, that's part of our charism. It doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the church and to the world. So we would embrace that. We would help with formation. We help with biblical formation. We help with any kind of theological formation that we feel is important. So they're not just, we feel lay people, associates, friends of Sion, are not just adjuncts to us. They are there in their own right within the church. And the charism belongs, it belongs to the church, but they can take ownership of it as much as we do.
You also have a contemplative branch, don't you, as well as your apostolic branch?
Yes. From the early 1930s, we've had a group of contemplative sisters in Brazil, in France, in Israel, now in Romania. And they're fairly small in number now, but very vibrant. They live, from the most part, alongside apostolic sisters in their own setting, with their own timetable, their own prayer life, their own little directions. But it's the same congregation with the same general leader. They have a superior or a leader of the branch, but it's the same congregation, obviously. And so this chapter, we are emphasizing more and more the closeness and the importance of our relationship, that within each one of us, there is the deep contemplative call, and within the contemplatives, there is obviously the deep call to announce the word of God.
Now, back in 2007, you began a kind of review and reform process of the congregation, didn't you? Tell us about that.
Yes. We, as general leadership team, we called a renewal. We called the congregation to a deep personal renewal, a renewal of their contemplative call deep within, and a renewal to look at what are we doing as a congregation? Who are we? One of the texts I used in my opening address here for the chapter was from Genesis 3. Where are you? God calling to Adam in the Garden of Eden. Where are you? Not in a harsh, judgmental voice, but where are you? So we called the congregation in 2007 and again at this chapter, where are you? What is happening? How are you modeling your life for new members? What are you doing in terms of our charism? How can we reconfigure? How do we accept ourselves as a smaller, very vibrant, deeply spiritually committed congregation? Where are you? That was the deep call at the 2007 renewal. which must continue and must be consolidated before any changes that we may hope to make at this chapter, before they can be implemented and consolidated, it needs a deep, deep personal renewal of God's word.
What kind of changes are you talking about? Can you give us some ideas, perhaps, for the future?
Yes. Yes, we would like, and most of our members are looking at, how can we come closer together? I describe it, first of all, primarily as a congregational mentality. Over the years, we developed into provinces. So we have the province of Brazil, we have the province of the Mediterranean region, the province of Canada, USA, Australia, the Philippines. Each became fairly self-sufficient, not autonomous, but fairly self-sufficient. It became tighter and tighter. Now we're looking to see, can we now transcend those boundaries? Can we now cross back, if we're British, can we cross back across the channel the way our early French founding mothers crossed the channel, crossed the oceans? Can we now not come back to Europe? I don't mean that. But in our mentality, can we let go of the province boundaries and become one congregation again? Reconfiguring in a manner where leadership is more efficient, where we share resources, personnel, as well as financial, as well as all the other resources that are available to us. Can we begin once again to have a very open congregational mentality that is intercultural, multilingual, with the same depth of wanting to know what is God's will for us now? What does God want for this project of God? The project of God belongs to the world. How can we, in our little space as Sisters of Sion, with this very extraordinary and specialised charism, can we make a difference?
Would you like to see this very special charism perhaps more used in the church as a whole?
Oh, yes, certainly. And, I mean, I think most congregations with an important charism feel that it's very important for the church. And without putting any other charism down, we would say the same. Of course, the recognition of Judaism as an essential element of our life in the Christian tradition is highly significant for us as Christians. And that basically, I think, makes us into educationists, formators. How can we facilitate a greater understanding of the richness of Judaism that we've missed for so many years, thousands of years, well, 2,000 years and more? How can we help people begin to appreciate the richness of the heritage of Judaism? Not to become Jews, I don't mean that, but to utilize their resources of God's word. They've been doing this for years, interpretations, and very often people studying the Bible don't use Jewish interpretation and Jewish commentary. That, we feel, is a great part of our role, that we make that bridge between the Jewish tradition and Christian tradition. How can we have mutual understanding? Of course, there are many Jews today who, and there'll be more liberal Jews, who recognize that they also cannot do without Christianity. Not to become Christian, but it's part of the context of our world.
Thanks there to Sister Maureen Cusick, outgoing Superior General of the Sisters of Our Lady of Zion. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.